Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a drop of spilt tea on the local cultural saucer. I'm James Sandy, and with my co-presenter Simon Mobbs, our theme is time and nostalgia. And in this show, you can expect music in the shape of Spiritualized, poetry from Julian Stannard, and we'll be looking at the literature of Jennifer Egan. We start tonight with music in the form of Spiritualized. So for the uninitiated, who are Spiritualized? What is our Spiritualized?
Okay, because they've got quite a unique sound, really. They're described as space rock, but maybe that's a little bit too broad. They're very idiosyncratic. They have ambitious contrasts within their music. You know, you've got raucous rock and roll, experimental drone rock, and then you've also got kind of heartwarming soul, gospel, lush cinematic orchestration. So, yeah, very kind of unique sound.
I'm guessing space rock's probably not a category that appears on many MP3 players.
Yes, no. So for a band that was very kind of big in the 90s, they've got a very retro sound. A lot of their influences are kind of from retro, old style American music. Okay, you've got some Wall of Noise experimentalism, which could link them to Sonic Youth, Mogwai, and other sort of 90s acts. But you've also got psych rock, Velvet Underground, Suicide, Hendrix, these kind of influences coming through. And there's an awful lot of American soul, blues, gospel, rock and roll coming through in their sound as well.
So they're very much about soundscape rather than just tracks and songs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got these kind of like dirge-like walls of noise and then these grand swooning symphonies. You've got kind of hypnotic, stripped-down, ballsy guitar repetition, and then also panoramic production with strings, choirs, and all the works going off.
And is dirge something we should be putting on our CD players at home, do you think?
Oh, yeah, it's a bit of dirge every now and then is good. Yeah.
I've not come across that. I'm going to have to check out dirge, I think, as a genre.
A sort of slow stomp kind of, you know, like you're kind of scrawling through mud rather than running, that kind of thing.
And is there something about their sound which is a bit of an indulgence for the artists, potentially?
Yeah, quite possibly. The sound is very linked to the front man, Jay Spaceman. I mean, he's the only kind of consistent member of the group. And in a lot of ways, Spiritualized are his group. In the same sort of way, you've got Marky Smith with The Fall. And his personal life, his interests are very much linked with the music. You can't really listen to the music without kind of thinking about him.
And is there, as the name of the band or the group suggests, is there a kind of religious, spiritual element to their work?
Yeah. I mean, quite often the lyrics are about love, addiction, mortality, that kind of thing. It contrasts quite a lot. You have quite a lot which are about rock and roll nihilism, about drug taking, about alcohol abuse, that kind of thing. And then you've also got other elements which are about religious repentance. For example, Lord, I'm feeling so weary, you better call a doctor in and give me one more chance. I won't get to heaven in the state I'm in. You know, things like this. You've got excesses there, but then you've also got kind of repentance for it as well.
So tell us about the gig itself that you went to at the Wedgwood Rooms. Kind of set the scene a little bit for us.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So when I headed off to see Spiritualized at the Wedgwood Rooms, it's worth mentioning that it was a sellout, which is pretty good going, seeing as a premium price ticket. I think that's testament to the following this band has. They had no support at all. So you arrived at, say, 8 o'clock expecting them to come on, and then you wait till about 10 o'clock before they actually got on stage.
I guess that was a conscious decision by the band themselves, not that they couldn't get anyone to support them.
I think so, yeah. There was a strong sense of anticipation in the air, and then when they finally did come on, it was like, you know, people were waiting for it, definitely. Myself, I'm a kind of what you call a medium to average fan of the band.
Okay.
You know, I've got three of their albums, but I've not like kind of got all six or seven of her albums or anything like that.
It's strange, actually, because knowing that we were going to discuss this band, I thought, well, I'll check out how many of their CDs I've got. And I would probably be in the same bracket. I've got 3 to 4 of their CDs.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, like a lot of people, I've got the Ladies and Gentlemen, We're Floating in Space from 97, which won the Mercury Music Prize, which I think really defines their career in a lot of ways. And then I checked out a few other things along that as well.
And I have that album, and you're very much into design, and I have a copy of that which is done as a large tablet, as a large pill, in a kind of blister pack, which I've still got intact, which is quite remarkable, really. But a really nicely produced kind of physical package for that.
Yeah, I mean, when that came out at the time, it was considered really quite interesting, wasn't it? Really quite unique. It links back to what we're talking about, this idea of excesses. Is it about self-medication? Is it about kind of, you know, health, that kind of thing?
So tell us about the kind of atmosphere at the gig and, you know, how they sort of open this finale, because obviously without support, I guess they were kind of straight into it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a relatively intimate gig space for the large productions that I've heard they put on sometimes. So I'm guessing that this is a relatively stripped down version of Spiritualized that we saw. they have such a large back catalogue, you're not quite sure what they're going to play. Now, they had this new material. There's an album coming out, Sweetheart, Sweet Light, in a few weeks' time. So really, it's a showcase for that. They hadn't gigged in quite a while, and the frontman had actually said he was nervous, shaky about the performance. So it's kind of like, is it going to go one way? Is it going to go the other? Well, the first opener was Hey Jane, which is the current single and one of the tracks off the new album. And that was really jolted the set into action. It was a great opener.
It's an interesting track as well, because it's one of the tracks that I was listening to prior to the show. And taking on board what you said about space rock, it really reminded me of Gene Genie, you know, David Bowie.
Right, yeah.
And I thought, it's not just the rhythm that it adopts, it's actually some of the lyrics and some of the vocals. I could hear an echo of that.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, David Bowie's kind of dabbled with soul and gospel and all those kind of genres as well.
I think he's done reggae as well. He's done a bit of everything.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But I think it's a great track. You know, it's got an urgent rock and roll kind of nature to it. It's very catchy. Also, what's interesting is it's got a radio-friendly kind of length, but then it reprises. So if you want to hear it on the radio, you could just hear the 3-4 minute version. But then it reprises and it kind of builds and builds into a crescendo on this second version. You've got Hammond organ, hypnotic kind of nature to it, relentless upbeat drum rhythm, the lead vocals between the singer and the gospels overlap, and it really works well. And you can see why a lot of critics have said, right, this is a return to their 1997 form.
There was an outfit, I think, called the Polyphonic Spree, who did a similar kind of orchestration, and it was very much the frontman versus the kind of vocal orchestra. And it's an interesting divergence, in particularly into kind of rock and roll music, and dare we call it pop, because it tries to link back to its roots effectively, you know. It's taking the kind of the gospel kind of framework of a lot of that kind of music and trying to jolt it forward into some kind of future age. So it's very experimental, I think, you know, at the very least you can say that about it. What about in terms of how the band looked? Because I've seen Jason Spaceman looking like the rough archetypal rock and roll star. Did they use any kind of visuals for the show, or was it very much just the performance? I'm thinking, you know, any kind of massive light displays.
The show was pretty good. I mean, I think the thing that's worth mentioning is he had next to no interactions with the crowd. I think the first thing he actually said to the crowd outside of a song lyric was when he said thank you at the end.
Right.
And even then, I wasn't sure he said thank you. It's kind of thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of thing.
Could have gone anywhere.
But that kind of added to the, I don't know, the enigma of him. You know, I think the people there as a following for him, you know, he knows that he's with his fans when he comes to perform. He's very cool, very staid. He had these large kind of trademark sunglasses on throughout, which might have been because he was kind of silhouetted against this white backdrop and like lots of strobe lighting quite often. So yeah, he looked great. He looked great against all of that.
And we're talking on this show about nostalgia and the nostalgic element of things. And did they veer into their kind of their old back catalogue and their old titles? And because I think, am I right in thinking that they're one of the kind of 90s bands that have gone out and kind of rekindled old albums traded on that slightly?
Yeah. My understanding is a few years ago, they did do the retouring of Ladies and Gentlemen, We're Floating in Space. They had the whole production. You paid quite a large amount for the tickets and you got what you paid for. But this is different. This was a mix of old and new. You know, you knew they would throw in a few old ones, but primarily they're there to deliver the new album and showcase it. I kind of heard a few in there that I was glad to hear again, you know. I think the one I enjoyed the most was something called 12 Steps, which is off the Let It Come Down album, which is quite a rousing, foot-stomping, rock and roll kind of track.
There are a number of artists at this game, I think, at the moment, in terms of, I don't know whether it's they want to secure mortgage payments or whether they've got a genuine interest to kind of try and revitalise some of their earlier work. Suede, for example, have done this recently, a crime in my book, because without Bernard Butler, they're not really Suede, even though I'm a huge fan. People like Belle and Sebastian have toured classic albums. Mm. Portishead famously have taken on the All Tomorrow's Parties kind of format, which I think Iggy Pop started around about 2005. And, you know, very strange idea of going to see a kind of an old band perform old albums and new bits in a holiday camp in Minehead, I think, which is a strange one.
Yeah, this idea of touring the back catalogue and the album dusting down approach. I mean, there's been quite a lot of this going on. You know, you've got comeback tours of the Stone Roses, Blur, and they're no doubt going to be playing an awful lot of their old material. You've also got recent album tours of artists like Tricky, Portishead, The Charlatans, lots from this 90s kind of era. I mean, even if you look at the Wedgwood Rooms locally, recently you've had Pop Will Eat Itself, the Inspiral Carpets playing, and you've also got Bentley River Mace coming up soon. So there seems to be something in the air. There's that kind of era seems to be coming back, and it's, do you do a greatest hits? Do you do an album rehash? What do you do? I've seen one or two like this, and I've enjoyed them. For example, I went to see the Screamadelica show at, from Primal Scream in Brixton, which I really enjoyed. But then I've also enjoyed gigs where I've gone to see new bands showcase the start of their career stuff, and there's a difference. I mean, when I went to see the Screamadelica set, it was, I went along with friends that I'd had from the time when I was listening to that album. You know, we went with the expectation we were going to hear those tracks. We heard those tracks, we enjoyed it, and then they did a little bit of an encore at the end, and it was good fun. Okay, maybe there's a certain amount, it says what it's going to do on the tin, there's not going to be any surprises, but, you know, maybe it's more considered more credible than the best of. You know, doing the greatest hits almost sounds like it's the last stage of that band's career.
The new album from Spiritualized, Sweetheart, Sweet Light, is out now on Double Six Records. We move now to poetry and the work of Julian Stannard. I was lucky enough recently to conduct a question and answer session with Julian at a meeting of Tongues and Grooves in Southsea. Julian Stannard is a lecturer in creative writing at the University of Winchester and has written many publications, including three volumes of poetry, is also a reviewer for The Guardian, and was awarded the Troubadour Poetry Prize in 2010. Julian, if we can start by just talking a little bit about kind of what brought you to poetry.
Goodness, I mean, it seems such a long time ago that I was seized that I can hardly remember. I'm always slightly embarrassed to admit this because I think one of the poems that really got me very excited about poetry was, in fact, The Wasteland. And I would have been about 16 or something, probably studying it for A-level. And, of course, you know, at that age you didn't understand anything at all. And then I think the teacher, trying to be a little bit alternative, he actually had a recording of Eliot reading The Wasteland in this sort of wonderfully sort of monotonous kind of Anglo-American voice. And I thought that was even better. And and I for many years, thought, oh, God, I wish I could have, I could cite some much more sort of, you know, radical reason. But I mentioned this recently to another poet, and he said, well, no, I mean, The Wasteland, in fact, is probably the perfect poem for adolescence. It's full of strange, beautiful noises, and, you know, he seemed to think it was a perfectly reasonable reason.
You mentioned at the start, I mentioned at the start, that obviously you, I suppose, do creative writing and poetry as a for a living now, but has poetry, I guess poetry is still a conviction to you rather than just a kind of a hobby or something that pays the rent? I mean, is it something more than a day-to-day?
Everybody, probably as a teenager, you know, writes poems, and then of course they grow out of it, and I suppose, you know, I never did. So I continue to write poems, and I think one of the great advantages, you know, I have colleagues who teach novel writing and script writing and all sorts of, you know, much more kind of well-paid literary forms. But it seems to me that, you know, you can sort of write a poem almost anywhere. You don't need a great deal of space, you just need a kind of piece of paper and a pencil. Yeah, that kind of makes it, I think, a very rewarding thing to do.
And what kind of, I'm always interested in this question, what kind of impact does teaching something like creative writing have on your creativity or the kind of the nature of your writing?
Well, I'd have at least two answers for that. I mean, I'd have the sort of totally truthful answer, which one can't always say. And then the slightly less truthful answer, which would be that, you know, if you're encouraging young poets to spend a lot of time, I think you're teaching a kind of brutalism. So I think it's very important that poets who are learning the craft, they must learn that they have to cut and cut and keep on cutting and maybe cutting again. And I suppose, in a way, if you're sort of making this a kind of mantra, it does make you think of your own work as well. So you have to go home and exercise a bit of brutality on your own work too.
And do you think in this amazingly kind of interconnected, wired world that we live in, do you think that the consumption of poetry has changed? You know, it's a bit like the consumption of music and literature. Do you think poetry's kind of been enhanced or kind of changed through that?
I suppose there are all sorts of exciting potentials, you know, kind of technological potential. I'm kind of so behind the game with technology that I guess that, I mean, somebody said to me the other day, you're probably like one of those kind of, you know, late Victorians, you know, when modernism was happening, you would have been going around saying, oh, this dreadful new stuff, you know, Ezra Pound and people like that. I hope I'm not like that, but I mean, I suspect I don't quite yet understand, kind of. I just keep on writing poems in the way that I wrote them before the invention of the internet.
Through some of the readings that you gave us earlier, it's clear to me that I guess landscape or kind of even cities to a point are quite important to your work. Would you say that's
yes,
reasonable?
Yes, cities, absolutely. I mean, I write a lot about London now, and I have to say that, I mean, Genoa is, again, a fairly big sort of port city. I live in Southampton, which I suppose you could say is another port city in a way. I often get asked to judge poetry competitions, and a vast number of the entrants seem to be about sort of sunsets and trees and birds and sort of lovely things in the New Forest. And I don't seem to ever write those kind of poems myself. So I maybe because I don't live there. But also I think these kind of poems have been so, you know, they're so written, aren't they? I mean, it's possibly quite hard to do something new about that.
Is there something, when you're a judge or a critic, is there something quite comforting about that? Because you're thinking, oh, thank God for that. It's not my piece that I've got to review. Is there?
Well, the comforting thing is that you often don't have to read the whole poem. I mean, you sort of one or two lines in, you can probably, it sounds terrible, you can probably discard it. I mean, I think most poems, you know, kind of betray themselves almost instantly. I mean, if the title is, you know, My New Pony in the New Forest, I mean, you hardly really want to read it that much. I mean, of course, it might be a masterpiece that's been discarded, but I doubt it.
I'm guessing some folks may have said that about The Wasteland when they read the title.
Well, they were wrong.
They were wrong.
I hang a blue towel on the line beneath the window. Then I walk around the flat in a melancholic daze. When I go for the towel a little later, I see that it's fallen and snagged on the line below. Next day, I'm staring out of the window, watching a girl taking her pants from the clothesline. I don't suppose you've come across a blue towel. Sure, she says, pop down sometime, carissimo. Early evening, and I'm pushing at her bell. She opens the door, and there's a blue towel wrapped around her head. I'm asked if I would like a little grappa, and soon there's a clink of glasses behind the curtain, and I'm looking at the room, which consists almost entirely of a bed, which is not unreasonable given her line of work, and a sprinkling of books, including a copy of Chameleon Tunes. She brings a tray with three glasses, one of which is full of ice. Do you like Billie Holiday? I must have nodded, because we sat there listening to some strange fruit hanging from the trees, sipping chilled grappa, her head wrapped so beautifully in my blue towel.
Do we have anyone who wants to ask a question from the audience that's here? Is anyone brave enough? There's a gentleman over there under the mirror.
Yes, I had a question. It's about the blue towel poem.
Oh, yeah.
What was this lady's line of work?
the blue towel poem. The lady's line of work was the question.
Well, I think, was it not fairly obvious? I mean, as I say, the wonderful thing about Italian street names is that they often are very evocative. So this was called the Street of Angels, and it was part of the red light area. And I just happened to be living in a block in which almost everybody else was involved in that activity. I mean, I wasn't. I was just living there. And it was kind of complicated for all sorts of reasons, because when you go into the front door of the palazzo of the block, you know, these ladies would be sitting outside, and their normal, you know, they would say, andiamo su, which means, shall we go upstairs? And of course, I would say, well, yes, because I live upstairs. You know, after a week or so, they realised that I just lived upstairs and I was there. They probably thought I was keeping an eye on them or something. I wasn't.
Do we have any other questions on any profession, not limited to that particular line of work? Yes, lady just back there.
You say you've been writing since you were 16. I was wondering, has your style changed much over the years?
Well, I hope it has changed, yes. I mean, I think I have come across bits and pieces I wrote when I was maybe 20 or something, not 16, and I think probably a good thing to do. I mean, one of the things I have to be careful about when I'm teaching, you know, 18, 19, 20, you don't want to sort of prevent them from writing highly kind of hormonal poems, because in a sense that's part of the delight of being that age. But I think as you get older, somehow you can't just rely on your hormones anymore. At least I can't.
Are there still kind of constant references or muses that you would have that you have now that since you were 16? Are there kind of enduring themes or?
Probably cigarettes, because I started smoking when I was about 15 or 16, and I still am, unfortunately. And it's a kind of terrible cliche, isn't it, to put poems about cigarettes, but they still sometimes get in there.
Tell us about some of the work that you've been doing recently and some of the books that you've got available. Available here this evening, I think.
It sounds rather grand. I mean, the latest book I wrote, in fact, is called The Parrots of Villa Gruber.
You pronounced it so much better than I did.
it is the third book in a trilogy. That sounds terribly grand. The first two books, the Rena's War and the Red Zone, are almost entirely about Genoa because I was sort of living there for many years. The Parrots book is less about Genoa, but there still is a section. I mean, I lived right next to a villa called Villa Gruber, and so that, in a sense, is the reason why the title is like that. But I am, because I'm now not living in Italy, kind of weaning myself away from Genoa. I mean, I spend a lot of time going back and forth to Italy, but I am writing. I'm not really writing about Southampton. I must admit, the muse in Southampton hasn't really come to me yet.
Surely you've yet to be inspired by IKEA.
I haven't even been there yet. But I say London. I think London is terribly. I think if you live in a big city or spend a lot of time in a big city, it seems to me quite easy to write about it.
So you said that book was the third in the trilogy. Is that the trilogy done and dusted, or will there be?
Well, there might be. I don't know what comes after a trilogy. Is it a tetralogy? There could well be more poems about Genoa. I think it's slightly worrying in a way, because I don't want to be the poet that just writes about Genoa, and I don't now, but I suspect there will be more poems about Genoa, but also more about living in England. I mean, I've been living in England now for 5 or 6 years, and coming back to England after having been away for many years, I think it's been quite interesting. You know, England's quite strange as well.
Yeah. It certainly is. Excellent. I think before Julian has to leave us, I think we've got time for one more reading. But before we set that up, if we can just show our appreciation to Julian. Thank you, Julian. We move now to literature in the shape of Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad. Now, this is a very strangely titled book, and I'm hoping, Simon, you can shed some light on it and perhaps tell us some of the meaning behind the title, at least. That's where we can start.
Okay, so the title, A Visit from the Goon Squad, is based on an Elvis Costello track called The Goon Squad, which is kind of fitting because the novel really centres around the music industry and people who work in the music industry. In the story, quite a few times, goon equals time.
This is really a kind of series of vaguely interconnected stories.
Yeah, that's right. It's 13 chapters, and each chapter has a different narrator, a different point of view. Within that, you have 13 different narration styles. So, for example, you've got one which might be a coming-of-age kind of story. You've got some which might be a satire on the media business. So a wide range of different kind of voices here.
And tell us about a couple of the main characters.
Okay, so although there's all these different characters, the ones that you maybe return to a few more times, if not through their point of view, through others, are Benny and Sasha. Benny Seltzer is an eccentric American-Mexican legendary music manager who kind of characteristically uses gold leaves in his coffee. And
don't we all?
uses pesticides as deodorant.
I don't think I go that far, but yeah.
Now, he is famous for breaking a garage rock band called The Conduits in the late 80s, early 90s, who are kind of like Iggy and the Stooges. We meet him in the 2000s, and he's becoming increasingly disillusioned with the music industry, the marketing and the production of the songs. And he feels it clashes with his original music passions as a teenager for the San Francisco punk scene. The other character, Sasha, is his very sharp-witted and attractive assistant within the music industry. She's also got quite a bit of an enigma to her. She doesn't seem to age. She seems to constantly stay one age. And despite her brilliance, shies away from career progression. She's also addicted to shoplifting, despite being in her 30s and having a very well-paid job, which we find out later is something to do with her troubled adolescence.
Some of the pundits that I've heard and read around this work have suggested that the different characters that Jennifer Egan uses are her way of, I suppose, becoming a different author for each section, you know, kind of using it as a platform to explore different writing styles. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. If you look at her previous novel, she varies quite a lot from kind of gothic kind of haunted house kind of story through to, you know, coming of age dramas and, you know, all sorts of strange kind of variations. Within the story, you jump from first person to third person. You jump, like, as I said, there's one story which looks like it's set in the future. There's one in a PowerPoint. So she's constantly challenging herself, constantly trying out new voices.
And she said, I think, in an interview that her influences include Proust, but also The Sopranos and Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. So it's quite a mixture of things. And is there a kind of cinematic quality to the book? I know a couple of other books have been filmed. I don't think this one has been filmed yet.
Yeah, so you've got these kind of very interesting sort of high and low influences of Proust. In particular, she's interested in the idea that Proust has within a lot of his writing, which is about time catching up with you and those moments where suddenly, bang, you're like taken back and you realise that a lot has happened and gradual changes have occurred, but it just suddenly gets you in an instant. Also, The Sopranos, you know, this idea of a large cast of characters over a long time span, and they're noticeably aging over this time span. So both of these kind of things are coming through in the story.
Now, you mentioned this at the start, and this is a very curious chapter, which is the PowerPoint presentation. Tell folks about that, because that's an interesting approach, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the PowerPoint chapter comes about last two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through the story, and it takes up a good 70 pages or so. And, you know, you could go into it thinking, okay, this is going to be a bit gimmicky, what's this about? But if you understand the reason for it, it's by a 12-year-old who prefers PowerPoint to normal writing. And she prefers to write her journal, her diary, in PowerPoint form. And that sounds pretty plausible once you start reading it. And it seems to make sense. In particular, she's interested with her brother's Asperger's-like obsession with great rock and roll pauses. That's the title, Great Rock and Roll Pauses. He meticulously tries to find out all the different pauses there are in rock and roll, times them, measures their effectiveness in this very kind of anal, but actually quite interesting kind of way. I found myself getting quite interested by these different pauses.
And I think, in a way, what's interesting about its usage here is that it's kind of a pause in itself to kind of music-related stories. So the suggestion is it is a great rock and roll pause, potentially. Personally, I'm not sure it works.
Yeah, I liked it. I think, you know, as well as the brother's obsession, you've also got a lot of here about her family life, and it looks at the everyday details, the conflicts, and also the moments of closeness between her mum, her dad, her brother.
So it's quite a worthy read. You'd recommend it?
Yeah, I would do. I would recommend it. I think it's got a lot of crossover appeal. On the one hand, it is quite literary and highbrow. It's won all these awards, like you were saying, and it does deal with big themes like the passing of time, the effect of time on the human soul, communication and way it's affected by technology, all these kind of things. But also it's kind of influenced by everyday culture, punk rock, The Sopranos, you know, generally, you know, everyday life. And I think that people who maybe don't read normally that much, who more often would watch TV programs or listen to punk, would listen to rock music, etc., would probably get something from it.
I'm off to the library to get my copy straight away. A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan is available now on Corsair. Well, just before we go, we've got time for a quick roundup of events in Portsmouth and the surrounding area.
Keith Vaughan's exhibition Romanticism to Abstraction, a retrospective of the UK painter, is on until the 10th of June at Pallant House Gallery in Chichester.
One of the greatest crooners, certainly in my lifetime, Des O'Connor, is playing at the King's Theatre on Sunday the 6th of May at 7:30. World-class star and ultimate entertainer. Get along to that.
On Thursday the 3rd of May, Death in Vegas are playing at the Wedgwood Rooms.
Just before we go, we should say thanks to Tongues and Grooves. My thanks to Simon Mobbs. I'm James Sandy, and we'll be back again soon.
Towards the Point is a King in the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.